That what would be good for us at this point, or good for me, or I don't know what, for our community, is rather than for me giving a talk this evening, to give a more open evening for a chance for you all to ask questions that you'd like to ask, or raise concerns that you have, or raise something for discussion. Partly because I feel like I've talked a lot many evenings, and without a lot of periods of questions and answers, and I think it'd be nice to hear what's on your minds a little bit and get a sense of that, rather than me just, you know, having another monologue up here. So, yes.
Well, I'm wondering if there are other people like myself who would appreciate some chanting or even some ritual added a little bit to what we do.
How many people here would like to have chanting as part of what we do? How many would like to have chanting on a very irregular basis? Thinking maybe it was a bigger group. And how many people would like to have some kind of event that separate from Monday or Sunday things we do, but some kind of event that incorporated chanting as part of it, chanting and meditation, and kind of made it much more kind of a whole different event that focused on such things. There's your answer. We'll do some chanting then on the 15th of May.
Could you, instead of having chanting on the 15th, maybe the week before then, have somebody hand out the chants ahead of time? So
you can go home and study?
Chant all the time. It's been a week for Barry.
Well, chanting is a wonderful practice. It's an integral part, traditionally, of Buddhist practice in all the different, many of the traditions, most of the traditions of Buddhism. We don't do so much of it in the Vipassana tradition because, partly because Vipassana was introduced to the West as a very simple kind of pared-down practice where the ritual and chanting that might alienate people was left out. But traditionally, it's a very important part, and it has a number of different functions. One function is very pragmatic. It helps quiet and concentrate the mind. Kind of the vibrations of chanting, the concentration on repeating the words, are just very helpful for concentration and purification of the mind. Some people say it doesn't really matter what you chant. You can just chant the telephone book and you'd have that effect. However, in Buddhist chanting, you're often chanting something that has some kind of religious value. It could be some kind of teaching that you're repeating, and by repeating it, memorizing it, and chanting it, it actually enters into your body and your mind in a very different way than if you just kind of read something or just heard it. It kind of enters into kind of the subconscious or into our, you know, I don't know what to call it. And it's quite wonderful to have memorized and absorb certain chants in the way they come out in unexpected times in normal life, in daily life. And so certain teachings, you know, certain teachings maybe aren't so clear or clear in a certain way. And because you have access to them, because you've learned to chant them and memorize them that way, in new situations, verses or lines will pop up for you. So, oh, I understand it in a new way. Yes?
Well, for that reason, it would seem important to use English. For the
meaning's sake, the English is useful. So a lot of the groups that I know, after they've been in America for a while, tend to switch over their longer chants into English. But also, chanting has a isn't just simply a matter of doctrine or learning teachings, but also it sometimes expresses a kind of faith connection to practice or to life or to the Buddhism or Buddha or whatever people have a faith connection to. It's also, when I was living in the monasteries, we would meditate first thing in the morning, and then after the morning meditation we would chant. And I was always very grateful for that time, because after the morning meditations I had a lot of gratitude. It was a very common experience for me. And I could have just gotten up and started my life, which, you know, but there's something actually very wonderful to have a channel of expression for that gratitude and that faith or that inspiration. And getting up and doing the bowing and the chanting as part of the service was a wonderful way of giving expression to what I was feeling inside. And also, occasionally it would evoke the feeling of faith connection because, you know, it's connected to something I had faith in, a devotion to some degree. And sometimes I hated it, you know, of course. You know, sometimes it's like, oh, what are these people doing here? And anyway, so it's concentrating. It's kind of a devotional activity to be done. So maybe those are you know, two primary reasons right now. And some people like to chant before they meditate. Some people after they meditate. Some people make their primary practice chanting, and they won't meditate at all. I like to occasionally chant when I'm in the car. Yes?
Naive question, I guess. Is there a book of chants? I mean, how do you learn about the different types of chants that you can chant?
Yeah, there are a number of groups that have published books of chants. They're a little bit hard to get copies of. And they're a little bit hard to use because... they're in English, some of them, but it's hard to get a sense of the rhythm of the chant from just reading the book. You almost have to learn it from someone who knows how to do it.
Are there tapes?
Dharma Seed Tape Library probably has some chanting tapes. And there's a copy, and Peter has a copy of some chants they use at Spirit Rock, which maybe you'll Xerox for next week.
Okay.
Pass out.
Peter won't be here.
Oh, Peter won't be here.
Somebody else can do it.
Courtney offered to do it.
Courtney, you do it.
And also, someone had me last Sunday, week ago, chant into our tape recorder the chants that I kind of do on retreats.
I have that too.
You have that too. So I don't know what's going to happen. I think it was meant for Elizabeth.
Yeah, I haven't seen her yet.
But I don't know, maybe something, if someone wants, you know, that, I'm sure it's available. What's nice about chanting, the number of nice things about it, one is that here in the West, many of us being Western rational pragmatists or many people have a certain reluctance to a lot of the ritual or the religiosity of Buddhism. They prefer the spirituality of Buddhism against the religiosity. And there's a tendency sometimes to go to Buddhist practice with the attitude of what's in it for me, you know, what's helpful for me, and I just want my calm, or I just want... And this ritual stuff or the chanting stuff, that's kind of... You know, I don't quite understand how it works. I don't understand what it's about. And it's not as rational as sitting down and, you know, just following my breath, as rational as that might seem. And part of the value of chanting is that I think it's for some people, a lot of people, I think it's easier if you can kind of get into it to allow let something happen to you which is not your agenda. Whereas when we meditate, it's very easy to have an agenda or have something you're measuring yourself against. You know, I'm supposed to get calm, or this is supposed to happen to me, I'm not doing well enough here, or, you know, sometimes meditation becomes this engineering project. And whereas chanting, people don't have any sense of that. They don't have any sense of some ulterior purpose. When you do devotional practice, it's just like, you know, you're kind of surrendering kind of to the just doing it. And chanting can have the wonderful effect of opening people up to something unknown, some unknown process or some unknown processing to happen through them. That where they're willing to kind of suspend their normal judgments and ideas and agendas and let some larger sense of reality than their own particular mind of, you know, self-controlled mind be in charge. Was that clear enough?
You know, Robert Gass, G-A-S-S, has just written a book about chanting that's really quite wonderful and comes with some tapes, and he dresses all of the chantings in all of the faiths from the American
Buddhism, the whole chant. And he's very engaging. He looks very good.
Thank you. Yeah. What other kind of concerns or questions? Could be questions about practice. You know, anything? What are some of your challenges? Yeah, Richard.
It was a sort of a small question that I've worried about many times. When you're sitting, you don't have a timer that rings. I was wondering how you know when the time is up without, like, do you start looking at your watch like 5 minutes before the end, or how do you sort of know when it's up? Do you ever go over?
you're probably convinced that it goes over sometimes.
I've never caught you going over it.
What?
I've never caught you going over.
Even though you suspected it. When I sit up here, I look at the watch. I periodically open my eyes and just kind of open it. It's very quick, and I just open and look. And sometimes, you know, I'm surprised how early I look. And and sometimes, occasionally, it's like, just in time. So but I do look. You know, and so usually I might look two or three times as it gets closer. When I was doing it quite regularly at the monastery, and it was always 40-minute sittings, then I had some inner clock. I just kind of knew after 40 minutes. So just 40 minutes. Oh, it's time. How you can sometimes set yourself to wake up a certain time in the morning. It was probably something like that. But I don't have that ability anymore. I don't do this regularly enough. Just once a week is not, Yes.
Another practice I've been interested in is contemplation practice.
Mm.
And I was wondering if you might say a little bit about that. And that also doesn't seem to be a big part of the way we practice here.
I think one of the things that's happening in America as the Vipassana tradition grows up here, we're kind of like reinventing the wheel. All these things that we were so eager to shed when we first came to America, we're realizing are actually important elements of the tradition. Or important elements of any kind of spiritual practice, and a lot of people are beginning to kind of incorporate them back in because Vipassana meditation, mindfulness meditation, is very powerful and very useful in many areas of life, but it is kind of narrow. So in terms of a spiritual life, and it's very valuable to kind of understand there's a lot more that you can do in a spiritual life, and one of the things that's very traditional. Is to do reflective, I call them reflective practices rather than contemplative practices, but to take on certain themes for reflection or contemplation and use a meditative mind to reflect on either particular practice themes or important issues in your life. One of the ways to do it is to sit and get as quiet and settled as you can in meditation, maybe sit for half an hour or 45 minutes. And then when you get as quiet and settled as you can, then switch out of your normal way of meditating. Really consciously know you're not doing that anymore. You're not meditating. You're not just doing mindfulness practice or concentration practice. And now you're going to do reflective practice. And in that very quiet space, ask a question or bring up a theme for exploration. Or just be by mentioning a word. One of the very classic themes of contemplation is death. And so a person might sit there and after half an hour of just sitting quietly and getting somewhat stable in their mind, then just popping the word, death. Just throw it into the mind or into the heart, just death. And see what happens. See the thoughts, the feelings, associations that might come up. And then maybe begin reflecting on it, thinking about death. And it's very, very valuable to do that, especially when the mind is somewhat concentrated. So in meditation, it's usually done somewhat passively. It's not like an active thinking and contemplation, at least that's the way I teach it. It's more kind of, you just kind of pop a question and see what happens and let the kind of associated thoughts kind of meander on their own rather than some kind of directed reflection. In my own life, I like to do more directed reflection by going for walks, and I'll take a Dharma theme, Dharma topic, or I'll take some issue in my life, and I'll go for a walk, and somehow in the walking, the concentration that comes from walking lends itself very well, in my case, to have a more focused analysis of the issue that I'm focusing on. So I'll take walking time as a time for very clear reflection. And it kind of helps a lot deepen one's understanding of certain topics, certain issues, but also it has a way of broadening the realm in which we include in our practice life. So we do it a little occasionally here in Palo Alto, because maybe, I don't know how often, 2-3 times a year maybe, at the end of a sitting I'll give you some reflective practices to do. Like a few weeks ago where we did the questions. And you know, something maybe we could do more often. Or yes?
It's a personal question. I'm wondering what your, like, if you have like a daily schedule that you follow, how often do you sit or how often do you walk? Personally, what's your...
Me personally?
Yeah.
I have a 2-year-old son. I'm not a very shining example of someone who has a regular practice anymore. My son wakes up too early for me to get up. I don't want to get up. I get home so late from here because I live up in the mountains, so I don't get to bed early enough to be able to get up before him. So he wakes up at 6, and so I get up at 6. But when he's up, there's no meditation, or a different kind of meditation. And so what I try to do is, I have in mind that, I have a commitment to try to sit every day, and so I'll try to do it as the first opportunity I get in the day. And so sometimes it's within an hour or two, sometimes it's within 3 or 4 hours, sometimes it's, occasionally it's not until I get here, on a Monday perhaps. Sometimes it's in the evening. So I don't have a regular practice in the way that I like to encourage people to have. And I don't feel so bad about it. I don't feel like I need to be the model anymore. I don't have to, I think it's very, very valuable to have a regular sitting practice and sit every day at the same time. But we have to accommodate ourselves a little bit to our conditions of our life, and my life right now is what it is, and I have to learn to be with that as it is. I like doing walking meditation, but I don't do that on a regular basis. I kind of fit it in when there's some time in my day, just where I'm waiting for someone, or there's a period of time in my day when I'm not doing anything particular, and I'll do some walking meditation. It just might last for a couple of minutes or 10 minutes or whatever. I don't know why you asked the question, but probably you didn't get a very useful answer. Yes, please.
A question about a concern, or maybe a difficulty that I'm having. Starting to increase the amount of meditation I've been doing, and doing it on a regular basis, and maybe I don't make it every day, but close to that, an hour or two, finding that I'm becoming more and more sensitive. I pick up things, energies, feelings from other people, and my intuition is a lot louder, I hear it more often, and so forth. And that's been wonderful and kind of expected, but what's been a little unexpected is that when I go out into the world and encounter stressful situations that normally were no big deal for me, now they're like a lot more challenging, and I feel them a lot more intensely. And it's almost like it makes normal life more, not less, difficult for me. And just wondering if there's anything you have to say about that, or it's just been a difficulty for me noticing that I am more sensitive to everything.
Yes.
And that makes the normal things that I used to tolerate just almost intolerable sometimes.
Yeah, I can reassure you in the sense that it's a common enough experience for some people that with meditation there's that greater sensitivity, and so there's also kind of sometimes a greater range of responses to the world, both difficult and wonderful responses. Ideally, as practice develops, there's also a greater equanimity. So it's in a kind of paradoxical way, there's greater intensity and greater range for some people of feelings, but there's greater equanimity, there's a greater sense of okayness about it being there. Some people find that meditation does the opposite effect. They have such a huge, you know, reactive range to begin with, that meditation kind of brings a more healthy balance. So it's somewhat common enough for people to have that experience you're describing. I don't know how to respond. My first kind of internal response to what you're saying, it was that knowing the way that many people live here in Silicon Valley and live very busy lives, and how somewhat bizarre some of the lifestyles are around here, and especially around work. I talked to two people today one person today who has an 80-hour work week, and was in bed last night at 2 o'clock in the morning with his laptop, and then got up 6 o'clock in the morning for a conference call, and worked Saturday and Sunday, and there's certain things which shouldn't be tolerated. So if our intolerance or our sense of difficulty around certain things and our sensitivity to them increases through meditation because they're really intolerable, maybe what's called for is to do something about it, to have some change, behavioral change, rather than feel that all you're supposed to do is just, mindfulness is just supposed to kind of help you kind of see things clearly as they are and just let things continue as they are. Sometimes we're called upon to make changes. And that can be very frightening for some people, because changes, big changes, for example, can be quite threatening to our, to our status quo. I think that what you'll find, also some people report what you're saying, because you can get a greater sensitivity to life, but at the same time, there hasn't been a deep enough personal reflection, personal exploration of the inner hooks and inner reactivity to how we respond to the world. And so if there's fear or insecurity or confusion or aversion or hate or something that, is operating back there, but never was there was a much of a problem, but somehow the greater sensitivity brings greater discomfort or greater happiness and lets those hooks latch on sooner, and that can make us quite uncomfortable. So it's very important to also make sure that our practice also at times is inward directed to actually what is our reaction to not just simply our feeling of sensitivity and the feelings that are evoked, but what is our relationship that we create inside of us to that. And if you're able to do that, step backwards and look at your relationship and clarify and purify that, then at some point you'll find yourself being able to be a much more open conduit, in a sense, open channel to quite intense experiences in the world. And you feel it very, very intensely while you're there, but there's no hooks for it. And so, it's quite okay. It just goes through you, in a sense, and you respond as responsibly as you need to do in the situation. But when the situation has passed, you don't carry that with you anyway. There's nothing lingers, no traces.
Maybe it's a transitory phase that I've actually been attempting to do exactly that. But what's been happening with that is that, at least lately, there's a lot of hooks, apparently. And that requires me to sit down and contemplate on those and meditate more. So it's almost like it starts feeling a little bit like an addiction to me. The more I meditate, the more sensitive I get. And then I realize I have these hooks. And then I got to sit down and realize why I'm being triggered like this so I can tolerate the situation. I got to meditate more. And then more hooks come up.
Yeah.
Maybe I took a step down the wrong path.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, the Surgeon General should have a warning before. the spiritual life doesn't does not usually, for the most part, or hardly ever, follow a linear progression. Especially linear progression from worse to better. from uncomfortable to more and more comfortable. It's more like a roller coaster. And what's progress in spiritual life doesn't always feel linear. You know, sometimes actually what great periods of mindfulness, of presence, of great openness, great experience of release allows for the possibility of stuff to pop up that wasn't really allowed to pop up before. And suddenly people will have, you know, great openings in practice, and then the next week or next months of their life are actually turn out to be very, very difficult. And it's kind of like, what happened to me? I thought I had this great, wonderful thing happen to me. And it's actually, you're ready for a whole new layer of processing. So we have to be respectful of the fact that there can be periods in a spiritual life that are difficult, and periods which are quite wonderful, and not to expect it to be any one way, but to learn how to kind of accept it all as part of the life. It's useful to look at a spiritual practice like mindfulness meditation as something something that spans many years or over a long period of time, so that we don't get so focused on what's happening on this particular meditation or this particular week or this particular retreat we're on, and we get a sense that you know what we're trying to do is to accept a great variety of waves that go through. Yes.
This is about forgiveness. It's been important, and I feel changes with it. But what comes up for me is this question of have you forgiven somebody? And whenever I get into a situation where somebody says, okay, bring somebody to mind who may have done something with you, I always get the same cast of characters. I've worked on forgiving these folks, and I've worked on the words, and I've held it and awareness, and all of it. But I keep getting the same cast.
So it's not finished.
Yeah. Apparently so. So how do you know when you're finished, or is it a finished process? Is it a finishable process?
Oh, yeah, I think it's finishable. Forgiveness is only necessary if there's resentment. That's the whole function of forgiveness, is to let go of resentment. So when there's no more resentment, then there's no need anymore. If you find yourself still lingering resentment, you don't forgive this practice, but it hasn't really gotten down to the core resentments that are there, then maybe you haven't felt or looked carefully enough at the resentment. And so forget about forgiveness for a while. Just kind of, spend some time, exploring the resentment or getting to know it better. And if you get to know it better, then it makes more sense maybe to do the forgiveness. The last one, Besha.
No, I just wanted to share something with Jim.
Yeah.
My experience of forgiveness. I was having great difficulty after 20 years of forgiving my ex-husband. I've been working on this for 20 years. And my therapist asked me if I had forgiven myself for my part in that relationship. And that opened up everything.
Nice. And
once I forgave myself, he's off the hook completely.
Nice. Beautiful. So what I'd like to propose, there's 5 minutes left to 9 o'clock, is that each of you turn to one or two people near you, preferably the people you know the least that are close to you, and introduce yourselves to them. And maybe you had some question you didn't ask today, or some reflections about what we talked about today, or maybe you just wanted to kind of just introduce yourselves and just meet someone. And just spend 5 minutes, meeting someone and talking with someone in the Sangha. And for about 5 minutes now, I'll ring the bell, and then we'll sit quietly for about 10 seconds. and then we can go home. Please.